Well, we haven't finished with Moses yet. I hope you remember where we got to the last time. We were thinking about the questions we would ask Moses. And we had been asking him what was it like to wait for God to come down, and how events started to happen at the place called Sinai in the wilderness. And God most certainly came down. There were great revelations of who God is and of his glory and of his power. Supernatural things were seen and witnessed. And then we asked Moses, what was it like to witness God doing something new? God did something new. He gave them what we call the law. And he had given that to Moses, and he had written it with his own finger, we read, on two tablets of stone. And we had looked at how the Ten Commandments were the beginning and foundation of that law, and what then came from that. We know that Moses read all that God had given to him in the hearing of all the people, and how that they had said, all that God said, we will do. At least three times they made that confirmation. All that God has said, we will do. Well, they're still at Sinai, and I want us to think of another question today that we might ask Moses, and it'll take us a wee while in the background before we actually get to it, but this is the question I'd like us to ask today. Moses, what was it like to get the offer of a lifetime? Well, when we left our studies, Moses was still up the mountain, and we read in Exodus 25 at the end of verse 18, Moses was in the mount 40 days and 40 nights. So he was there and he was with God and experiencing that closeness with God. Even though that would be a fearsome and awesome thing, especially after all the things that they had witnessed. But Moses was there, that closest place with God. Now while he was there, he had already put Aaron and Hur in charge of the people in his absence. We read about that in Exodus 24 and verse 14. And he said to the elders, tarry ye here for us. The us at that stage is Moses and Joshua. Until we come again unto you. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. And if any man have any matter to do, let him come unto them. And Moses went up into the mount. So we're going to go over now a few chapters, because there's a lot to do there with the details of the giving of the law, and it's not a verse-by-verse exegesis of the book of Exodus, it's the story of Moses we're dealing with. So we're going to jump over to chapter 32. So, Aaron and Hur have been placed in charge, Moses is in the mount with God, and the total time of his being there was going to be 40 days and 40 nights. So at some point, probably towards the end of that time, we read this in chapter 32 of Exodus in verse 1. And when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, the people gathered themselves together unto Aaron and said unto him, up, make us gods which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we know not what has become of him. And Aaron said unto them, break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, of your sons, and of your daughters, and bring them unto me. And all the people brake off the golden earrings which were in their ears, and brought them unto Aaron. And he received them at their hand, and fashioned it with a graving tool. After that he made it a molten calf. And they said, these be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made proclamation and said, tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. And they rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. And the Lord said unto Moses, go, get thee down. For thy people, which thou broughtest out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made a molten calf and have worshipped it and have sacrificed thereunto. And said, these be thy gods, O Israel, which have brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And the Lord said unto Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. One of the saddest passages, surely, in the history of the children of Israel. Now, there's a couple of issues regarding this. The first is that after all the supernatural displays of God's power and glory that the people had seen, and the new law that had been read to them, we find them capable of this behavior. And that's the first issue that I'm sure immediately came to your mind as you read that. But then there's another issue, because Aaron and Hur didn't immediately turn to the Lord for guidance and direction when the people came to them. Aaron and Hur, in fact, didn't immediately turn to what had been read to them, so we could say, the known and revealed Word of God, whenever the people came with that request to them. Is it any wonder God, much later on, says to Judah in Isaiah chapter 30 and verse 1, "Woe to the rebellious children that take counsel, but not of me." In other words, they discuss, they plan, they plot, and so on, but they don't ask me. So how has this happened? How has this come to be? Well, it may well have begun with impatience. Is anybody here impatient? There's a lot of chuckling and stuff going on. Is anybody here laid back? Does anybody here know somebody in the church that's laid back? And of course they were really saying, whenever this starts to kick off, "Where's Moses?" Now, he's not away in the grand scheme of things an awfully long period of time. In fact, when you look at how God has been working in Moses' life, 40 days and 40 nights is nothing. But they were impatient. "Where's Moses?" What they were really saying was, and they maybe had some reason for coming to this conclusion, if it is right, all of these supernatural things that have been happening, Moses has gone up, we can't see Moses. Is it possible that Moses has done something he shouldn't have done? He's gone too far when he shouldn't have, and God has smitten him dead. That may be, and that's given them being gentle to, being kind to them. But when we unravel it and see God's reaction to this, God doesn't give them that. He knows their heart. And he knows that their impatience has nothing to do with a worry about what might have happened to Moses. They are just a demanding people. "He should be here with us." It mattered not to them that Moses was spending time with God, and Moses was there because God was keeping him there. That mattered not to them. Here's a congregation, and it's all about them. Isn't that sad? And the flesh always needs to fill the void. You wonder why there's so much available at our fingertips today to keep us entertained, to keep us distracted, to fill up our day, to fill up our heads, to fill up the minds of our young people. Why there's so much today that there wasn't when I was growing up and when you were growing up as older people. The flesh must fill the void. Why is there so little of God? There's so much of other stuff. That's why we're making Tuesday a different day. And they wouldn't wait on Moses, who was waiting on God. So really, they weren't waiting on God. Psalm 130, verse 5, Psalmist says, "I wait for the Lord, my soul doth wait, and in his word do I hope." Impatience led to disaster, and it has done many times in the Word of God. You think of Abraham and Sarah. God had promised that there would be a son, and promised Abraham that the seed would be like the stars of the sky and the sand of the sea and so on. But Abraham and Sarah because of their advanced years, refused to trust God and to wait upon God. God made the promise. And they decide to do something about it. And the result, of course, is Ishmael. Then, of course, whenever they eventually have Isaac, Isaac's son Esau does something else that shows impatience. And he's guilty of a desire for instant gratification when he comes in from hunting and he sells his birthright. Impatience. We think in 1 Samuel 13 of Saul making an offering without waiting for Samuel. Again, serious and wrong. We think of the story Jesus told of the two sons, one of them, the younger and the elder, and the younger wants his birthright here and now, he doesn't want to wait till his father passes away. Impatience. And in each of those cases of impatience, there's a picture of getting away from God. There's a picture of how it all goes wrong. Not waiting on the Lord. Wonder is that true of somebody here? Wonder is that true of somebody who has done something rashly? Or who, in waiting for God, has given up, has got fed up, has decided to take matters into their own hand? The seriousness of being impatient. And these people, in their impatience, they think, well, if Moses is out of the picture, we're going to still have a picture. And they think that they need something. Without him, they need something else. They think they need images. They think they need to see something. A God that is visible. They have been hearing thunderings. They've seen lightnings. They have had all of these supernatural phenomena around them at Sinai. But only Moses and on some occasions a few others have seen just a hint of God's glory. Even Moses, at another point when we get to when he is asked to stand in the cleft of the rock, he only sees the back part of God's glory. And they are thinking, we want something we can see. They felt they needed to see their God. And that's a trap that many people fall into. But what they really needed was faith. And as we in our book, the book of Hebrews, saw, that was what God condemned these people for over and over and over and over again. They had no faith. It was that they hadn't faith. It was their unbelief. And here we find it again. Instead of having faith in the invisible God, whose power they had seen displayed, they would rather have seen a visible God. And God says to Moses, they have quickly turned aside from the way that I have commanded them. Now notice the subtlety of this situation that's happening here. Because they didn't just say, we're going to have this idol, this image that we will create ourselves, and we're going to abandon Yahweh, Jehovah, the God of Israel. They were going to still have an altar unto the Lord. That's in our reading. Aaron still puts an altar unto the Lord alongside this image. So what they were really saying is, we want an aid to worship. And that's the problem that our Roman Catholic neighbours have with their statues and the Orthodox people with their icons and even the Anglican people in many cases. They think this is an aid to worship. I can come before this depiction of whoever and it helps me in my worship. But they would say, but I'm still worshipping God. Now, how can it be a helpful thing to worship God in a way that God abhors? In a way that is an abomination to God? Of course it can't be done. It's impossible. So this, if you like, first transgression of the new law is a most serious transgression of the new law. It wasn't some person who happened to let their animal into somebody else's territory and it maimed a person. It wasn't something like that. This is a most serious transgression of the law that had just been given. This first transgression is a serious one. It's a wee bit like the Garden of Eden. And after the sin of Adam and Eve and the curse that it brought, one of the first things we read about is murder. Cain kills Abel. Most serious transgression. It wasn't just a stealing some wee thing. Where was Moses? Well, they should have known Moses by now. And that lets me see something about their focus is on themselves, not on their great leader, the great man that God had given them. Where was he? He was close to God. Wouldn't you want your leader to be close to God? He was receiving instructions from God. And what were these instructions? It was all about, if we boil it all down, about holy living. It was all about separated living. And living in a way that would display the reality of God amongst the nations that would surround them. It was going to be about holy worship in a holy place called the tabernacle, through a holy priesthood, using holy vessels, wearing holy garments, standing out from all others around them. And Moses was there, close to God, receiving these instructions. And all of this was going on at the bottom of the mount. How unbelievably sad. And God saw, and God heard, and God was able to quote to Moses what the people said. So they form an image. They gave willingly of their possessions, and these earrings and items of jewelry, whatever exactly they were, we can only imagine that people who had been making bricks in Egypt for centuries, who had been reduced to slaves, and their number had grown from a family to thousands and thousands, that these must have been the items that the Egyptian people gave to the Hebrews as they left Egypt. Makes sense. We read of that, so we need look for no other explanation. But here's the thing. That spoil that came from the Egyptians was intended to be used eventually for the construction of the tabernacle of God. But what do we find? We find they're putting them on. We find they're trying them on. We find that they're adorning themselves with these items. And not only that they then give them to Aaron and insist that he forms them into some kind of image. You know, after God has dealt with their sin, we read over in the next chapter, Exodus 33, verse 4. And when the people heard what God had just said, these evil tidings, they mourned, and no man did put on him his ornaments. Aaron was saying to the people, take off your jewelry, give it to me, and I'll give you what you want. You know, that sounds a wee bit like some of the televangelists that we hear of, and whose programs are streamed and are shown 24/7. Most of them, I suppose, are coming from America. And what are they saying? Send me in your tithe and you'll get what you want. Isn't that right? That's more or less what it boils down to. Do you have a need? You know what they're really doing? They're really saying, I'm going to exploit you as a vulnerable person who has a need, and I'm going to take off you and promise you that God will just, you're claiming, claim it and name it brigade. How sad. And yet that's what many people today think the gospel is. Well, an image is produced in some way, and it looks like a calf. Perhaps they were trying to make it look like a lamb. These be the gods that brought you out of Egypt. But anyhow, it ends up looking like a calf. Over in the book of Joshua, chapter 24 and verse 14, we read this, a phrase in hindsight. Now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your father served on the other side of the flood, speaking there of Jordan, so that's this period, and in Egypt. So there we discover that whilst they were in Egypt, they were tainted with Egypt. You know what Egypt is, as we've said over and over again? It's a picture of the world. Pharaoh, often a picture of Satan. And here they have come out of Egypt. And you can take the people out of Egypt, but Egypt wasn't out of the people. You know, we who are saved today, we should be saved out of the world. But sadly, so much of the world is still in us. They were thinking back to what they had in Egypt, and that's the method they employed, with a total disregard to God having given them something better and something new. So they have a feast. Exodus 32 and 25. And when Moses saw that the people were naked, for Aaron had made them naked unto their shame among their enemies. You know, whenever the Lord gave the Ten Commandments, just at the end of that passage in Exodus 20, we read from verse 24, the Lord forbids the construction of high altars. They're going to have an altar, it has to be low, it has to be made of earth, unhewn stones. And that's to prevent people going up these high steps, and that even a part of their body would be exposed. No flesh to be exposed in God's presence. And sadly, I've been in services in church where you'd nearly think it was as much bare flesh as could be managed was exposed in the Lord's presence. Could that be right? But others have said that naked is not a good translation. It should rather be unrestrained, running wild, or broken loose. And certainly that ties in with what we then read of, what Moses sees whenever he comes down the mountain and sees it for himself, that they were out of control, and that Aaron had allowed them to get out of control. He hadn't restrained them. So what were they at? Verse 17, Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted. Verse 18, the noise of them that sing. So they were singing loudly, enthusiastically. And then verse 19, and the dancing. But at the end of verse 6, has an interesting little phrase. We'll read the whole verse. They rose up early on the morning and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. That word to play, itzak in the Hebrew, it does mean to laugh and to mock and to play. And that sounds innocent enough, but there are other scriptures where it's used and you get the feeling that it means something a wee bit more than that. For example, in Genesis 26 and 8, it came to pass when he had been there a long time that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out at a window and saw, and behold, Isaac was, and here's the same word, but it's translated sporting with Isaac, with Rebekah, his wife. A husband and a wife. A situation that carries a sexual overtone. This has led many commentators to talk about it being a drunken orgy, but we don't know where they get the drink from, because they're relying on God to provide them with manna and water from a rock. But what they were doing required none of those influences. There was enough in them, without blaming it on anything else, to end up in this unrestrained way, doing what they did, which was entirely of the flesh. That's the point. This was of the flesh, and therefore it wasn't true worship. We want to be worshippers, don't we, who worship in spirit and in truth, and it's the truth side of that that will instruct us how to worship. And if we're doing it in spirit, it's the Holy Spirit. And therefore our worship will be right. Don't we want to be worshippers who worship in spirit and in truth? This is the background to the question we'd like to ask Moses. We want to ask him what it was like to get the greatest offer, the offer of a lifetime. You know, in chapter 24 and verse 7 of Exodus, we read, Moses took the book of the covenant and read it in the audience or the hearing of the people, and they said, all that the Lord has said, we will do and be obedient. Exodus 19 and 5, the same thing. All the Lord has spoken, we will do. Exodus 24 and 3, all the words which the Lord has said, we will do. And yet, the second commandment is broken. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven images or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them. That's why we read that to fail in one point of the law is to be guilty of all. And that's the seriousness of what was happening here. And when Moses comes down and sees it all for himself, he wants to know what Aaron's been up to. Let's read verse 21, Exodus 32. And Moses said unto Aaron, what did this people unto thee? In other words, did they tie you down? Did they put a gun to your head? What did they unto you that thou hast brought so great a sin upon them? And Aaron said, let not the anger of the Lord of my Lord wax hot. Thou knowest the people, that they are set on mischief. For they said unto me, make us gods which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man hath brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what has become of him. And I said unto them, whosoever hath any gold, let them break it off. So they gave it to me, I cast it into the fire, and there came out this calf. Almost as if he had hardly anything to do with it. He had just gone with the flow, and this miraculous calf was suddenly formed. Aaron's making excuses for his sin. Haven't we all done that? As I said, sins of commission, sins of omission. We all make excuses why we don't pray more. Or why we don't encourage others in the fellowship by our attendance at the place of prayer. And pray for others too. Aaron wasn't calling sin, sin. That takes me back to something I said in our earlier studies whenever Moses had an encounter with God at the burning bush. And you remember the excuses that Moses made? And then amongst those excuses, he asked for an assistant. And the Lord said, Aaron, remember I said back then, be careful what you ask for. How that would come back to haunt them. And that's not the only thing Aaron might do. But here we find this awful thing. And Moses is grieving. He has the disappointment of that perhaps a parent might feel over a wayward child. The disappointment that a pastor would feel over a congregation that doesn't listen. The disappointment a youth leader might feel whenever some young charge goes wrong. And on we could go. And I'm sure that this man in his 80s just felt like walking away. But you know, Moses' disappointment is nothing compared to God's. And God shares it with Moses. And he doesn't pin any blame on Moses. And there's a very interesting verse, and this is really where we get our question from today. And it's in chapter 32, verse 10. God speaking to Moses. Now therefore, let me alone, or let me do this, that my wrath may wax hot against them, the children of Israel, that I may consume them, utterly destroy them. And here's the interesting little phrase, and I will make of thee a great nation. The offer of a lifetime. We today could be saying, the God of Moses, instead of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and so on. We could be, instead of saying land of Israel, the land of Moses. The Mosesites instead of the Israelites. We could be thinking that way because God says to Moses, I'm going to destroy them. I'm going to get rid of the lot of them. And I'm going to begin again with you. I wonder how you would have reacted to that. Especially as you were as disappointed as Moses was. Especially as you were as close to God as Moses was. Especially as you had nothing but complaint from these people. Think about that. What would you have done? You probably would have allowed him. That's a good idea, Lord. God was going to get rid of Israel and start again, but that would mean abandoning all God's promises. And here we find the meekness of Moses, because there's a verse over in Numbers chapter 12 and verse 3 which says this, Now the man Moses was very meek above all the men which were upon the face of the earth. And in light of this great offer that was made, we see the meekness of Moses. Whenever Moses describes this more in what I would call his own words over in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 9 from verse 16, this is what he writes about the experience of this time in verse 20. And the Lord was very angry with Aaron to have destroyed him, but I prayed for Aaron. There's meekness. There's Moses coming down to chaos, to a mess, to his brother who had been placed in charge. And now God's disappointed and angry, and Moses is disappointed and angry, and the people have been caused to sin. They haven't been restrained. And yet we read these meek words. I have prayed for Aaron. Isn't that amazing? And there we see the response of Moses to this wonderful offer. He just begins to intercede for the people. From verse 11, And Moses sought the Lord his God and said, Lord, why doth thy wrath wax hot against thy people?